Welcome to the Yoga Therapy Hour. Today, I have my friend, my colleague, and someone I really admire on the Yoga Therapy Hour as our guest. Her name is Rachel Krenzman, and Rachel has just written a memoir, and it's called As Is. You can find out more on her website, rachelkrenzman.com. And, you know, I got the pleasure of seeing this book many years ago in process as she was writing down the different things that had happened to her in her life. And it was all coming together. And I remember at the time she was saying, I'm not sure that I even want to publish this. I think you'll hear in this interview that she decided just to write as if it would not be published so that she could be free to say what she really wanted to say and not feel hindered. And it is so raw. It is so authentic. It is the next Eat, Pray, Love. I'm not even kidding you. Like, she's had an interesting life. She grew up in a very Orthodox Jewish family in Montreal. And there's a whole section of her life that is so fascinating. From the first pages of the book, you're drawn in like, is this for real? And then she gets her freedom. She's liberated. She moves to San Diego, California, and spends time in Mexico and in the ocean. And you can just feel the expansion. First phase was kind of contracted a bit. And then you just feel this freedom and expansion. And as she says, there were no boundaries now. It was just do what feels good and be and feel. And that it's almost like a whole different person got to emerge. And then there's part three of her life where she's living right now, the last 10 years, where she decided to take her children and move to Israel. And that is a completely different experience, especially I'm sure you can imagine the last few years with all that's been going on with the wars in Israel. And it's a whole nother almost lifetime that doesn't seem like it could be the same person that went through the Montreal phase and the California phase. And then throughout all of this, we have Rachel's love of yoga and yoga therapy and her ability to bring yoga therapy into the hospitals in Israel. I don't know how she's still moving forward with all of this in spite of all that has happened, especially more recently. It takes fortitude. It takes persistence. It takes grit. This girl's got grit. So for any of us kind of sitting home feeling sorry for ourselves that the perfect job has not arrived on our doorstep in a beautiful package that we get to open, I want you to get this book. I want you to listen to this interview and just think about the tenacity that it takes to keep moving forward towards your dharma. That's really what I see here with Rachel, that she has come home to herself. In the book, she's a young woman coming of age, figuring out who she is. And I think it's a story for all of us to let go of our shame, let go of worrying about what people think of us, and to really live in our purpose and to allow our true selves to be seen and not feel so judged. I mean, there are people out there that will judge. But that's none of your business. That's none of my business. That's none of Rachel's business. If people want to judge, that's for them to do. That's separate from who you are or Rachel is. That true nature, that light inside each one of you and inside of Rachel is really what I'm left with at the end of this interview. That there's something much deeper than our stories. So even though the book had a wonderful story and it may become a movie one day, it also reminds us we are not our story. So I am so happy to introduce you to Rachel, and I hope you really enjoy this interview. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Yoga Therapy Hour. This is Amy Wheeler. We're in the second half of 2025, and we've spent this entire year telling stories of health, healing, and beyond with yoga therapy, yoga, and Ayurveda. I hope you'll join us for the second half of the year where we hear people who are courageous and generous and authentic and kind telling about their life experience so that they can help others out there who might be going through something similar. Let's get into season 9 and hear more stories about people just like you. All right, on to the show. Welcome, Rachel, to the Yoga Therapy Hour.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
Rachel, where are you joining us from this evening?
I'm joining you from Ra'anana in Israel. It's afternoon, our time.
Yeah. We'll dive into how life is going for you a little bit later, but I just want to start off by congratulating you. You have a new book out that is called As Is.
Yeah.
And I'm just blown away. I don't know if you remember, but you had allowed me a couple of years ago to kind of read some of the earlier drafts. And at the time, I was like, wow, this woman is so brave and so courageous. I was like blown down. But now in reading the whole book and how it's turned out, I'm even more in awe. I'm seriously almost like breathless or speechless because it's emotional.
Yeah. It was really hard to write.
Tell us about how you're feeling about this release.
It's been a long time coming, and I didn't even know if it would actually get released and if I would actually go through with publishing the book. It took me about 10 years of writing and editing and rewriting and putting it down for a year and saying, I don't even want to look at this anymore, or I can't look at this anymore, and then picking it up again. So it's been through a lot of stages, I will say, a lot of ups and downs. And finally, kind of a sitting there in my inbox, and I said, if I don't actually take it out and do something with this, it's not going to happen, you know, because it came to that point where I felt like I was done. I was done with the writing, and it was just a matter of really putting it together and editing. And that was kind of a moment where I decided, am I ready to be naked in front of the world? You know, am I ready to bare my soul? And I think because the process was so long, I needed the time to be ready. And in fact, once the book was published, interestingly, and I got the books delivered to my house, they sat in boxes for 2 months before I actually had the courage to open them and to share them with the world. So yes, the process of being honest and open is really not easy. I felt that it's the time. It just felt like the right time.
I love what you just said about being open and honest is not easy. I mean, that's really the thing I took away from the book is maybe some of us don't have as interesting of life as you have had, but I've rarely known women to be this honest and open and allow themselves to be seen naked, not just on the cover of the book, but metaphorically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually. Like you laid it out there for all of us to get honest with ourselves and for all of us to not feel shame.
Mm-hmm. Like,
big deal. If Rachel can do it, we can do it.
You can definitely do it. I'm not anything special. It's just that I think yoga really helped me a lot in the process of not identifying as much with my story so that I could separate me from the story that I'm telling. In other words, I think the process of practicing yoga for 25 years and being in yoga therapy, and then as I talk about in the book, going into somatic psychology and really mind-body healing, helped me realize that I was doing the best that I can with the tools that I had. And a lot of my defenses and things that I, you know, habits and patterns that I had, which we learn in yoga therapy and in yoga philosophy, didn't identify me or didn't define me. They were what I used and what I needed at the time to survive in a difficult situation with the tools that I was given. And so as I continued to like separate a little bit from the shame, I guess, of being me and having the thoughts I was having or the behaviors I was having that I wasn't happy about, as that started, there was just more space. Then I said, okay, this is now a story. And that was part of my process of writing it, was the process of saying, this is my story. This is the story. This is not my essence. This is not who I am. Who I am is what I find, you know, when I step on the mat or when I have time alone in nature or when I'm my best self. But the story can live as a separate thing and it doesn't have to define me. And I hope that it helps other people who are living with, you know, difficult feelings, addictions, patterns. I hope it helps them see that that's not their story, that they're sort of, coping the best way they can, and that there is a way out, and that they shouldn't feel ashamed of who they are.
And quite a story it is. I mean, I hear what you're saying, that there is a part of you, as we know in yoga, that is all-knowing and free of fear and attachments and aversions and ego identification, that there is an eternal part of you, a bright light. And your story is so fascinating and interesting, and it just draws us in from the very start. So, like, both of those things are true, right? So your story, if we go with the Prakriti side of it, is really a young woman coming of age. And one thing that struck me as I started reading the different chapters of the book and I started writing it down is this story, this part of you, in relationship to so many different men in your life that have had positive influences, not so positive influences. I just started writing down their names and I'm not going to read all of them, but wow, I realized that as you're coming into your maturity and you're being a woman who believes in herself and knows who she is and can stand on her own two feet, it's always in this juxtaposition to your father or your one of your husbands or maybe even your sons or Adil, your yoga teacher. Like, it was so interesting to see you go back and forth between here's a really important relationship in my life, and then here's who I am as a woman as a result of that. Did you see that pattern when you were writing it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's funny because I have two sons and I'm remarried now, and he has three sons. And I'm like, why am I always living in a room or house full of men? And my dogs are boys and everyone's male. And I feel like there's some kind of karmic thing. I remember thinking my whole life, because of my father, if you read the story, you'll kind of see his character. He was very shut down. And I remember thinking men don't have feelings. This was my belief. I really, really believed that men didn't feel the same way that women feel. Okay. So I related much better with women because I felt like they were more emotional and men were kind of cold. I don't think it's an accident that I found male yoga teachers. Two of my primary teachers were male, and then the others were women as well. But two of my primary teachers are very gentle, very warm, very loving, kind men. And I always wondered that. I said, it's so interesting that I found sort of a corrective experience in having men that were strong and smart and leaders, but they were also very kind and very generous and very warm, almost in a way that was father-like, something that I was missing when I was young. So I agree with you, it's not an accident. And I think a lot of my life was reconciling my relationship with men and realizing that they have feelings the way that we do. I know it sounds silly when I say it out loud on camera.
Let's go back to the beginning. In chapter one, I just had this empathy for you about the cognitive dissonance between you walking into, I think it was a bar mitzvah, and you were putting on a face. I have this written down, maintaining a face to the community, knowing that your father had just been arrested and he was a rabbi. We don't have to go into all the details, but I mean, imagine a young woman like, your father is a community leader. He's a rabbi. He's now in prison. And you're moving through the community almost as if it didn't happen.
Yeah, it was really strange. It was a really strange experience, very surreal, because at that point nobody knew. It hadn't come out since it was so new. And I was told by my mom that, we can't tell anybody anything and we're just going to pretend that everything's fine. Got dressed up, traveled, went to this bar mitzvah, acted normal. And the whole time, it just really felt so strange to just be in a situation and acting normal and thinking about what he must be going through, realizing that everything is a big lie. All I can say is it's a surreal experience. I
And
almost don't remember it. It's the memory is hard to draw up.
I almost felt disassociated reading it. I was like, oh my God, this is too much. And then to kind of continue reading and realize, like, I can see why you didn't think men had feelings. I mean, you had said at one point that he took you to help you learn to ride a bike, I think. And that was like one of the first and last days the two of you really spent any time together as father and daughter.
Yeah, there was a lot of, open communication. I do come from a very religious background, and I realize that not everyone is like that, even in a religious background. He was just kind of a very stern, a little frightening in a way. He was never abused us. He never did anything like that, but he always kind of held himself above. And so we were always sort of trying to please him, but there never was a way to please him. I guess that was the feeling. And he didn't have a lot of emotion. He didn't show a lot of emotions. Every little bit that we could get as kids was treasured. But there weren't that many moments that I recall. Again, I don't remember a whole lot, which I also thought was normal not to remember your childhood. And then as I started talking to people, I realized that no, this isn't normal, that I really don't remember a huge chunk of my life. And the memories are sort of very sporadic as events. And you can see that in the book as well, that I kind of recall certain events, but there's a lot I don't remember. And I remember through photos. When I look at photos, often I can remember that day or that time. But a lot of it's a blur and still is.
Do you feel that on some level, this book also kind of shows generational trauma and how it came down through so many generations and landed in you?
Yes. So it's one of the underlying themes. There are many themes in the book. And so, I encourage people when they read it to sort of read between the lines and to look at all the sub stories. But it's one of the themes. I started to wonder how it was for them to grow up. My mother has a story of, running away from Hungary when she was 9 years old through the woods, getting away, during the war and leaving their home in Budapest and coming to the United States and starting with nothing. And there's a lot of that. And my father was American, second generation American, but his family was still from Eastern Europe. And I do believe that a lot of the themes around money, owning things, having beautiful things, status, even just the way that we had to show face to everyone, we couldn't really talk about our feelings. We had to show that everything was fine all the time. There wasn't any room to be messy. All of that, I think, just came down through the channels.
Okay. Whew, you said there's not any room to be messy. So I was reading this, imagining my own messy story. Did you have to get permission from people to publish this? Because there's a lot of detail. Like, how did that happen?
That was my big concern, actually. That was one of my biggest concerns when I was writing the book. The people I was most concerned about are my family members. So first I wrote, and I worked with a creative coach who really helped me through. I just was writing for many years, and I had a lot of stories. And then I had to figure out, how do I put this together into a book, and how does it, flow, and where do I start? And do I tell it in reverse, or do I tell it in little vignettes, or in a real timeline? And so there's a lot that went into kind of putting it together. But I was told, just write. Just write. Don't worry. Don't worry about it, because we didn't want to put a lid on things. I didn't want to be cautious when I wrote, just for myself. And then I worked with editors and worked on things that we could tease out or things that we thought were too much, to try to make it as neutral as possible. So it's not just my feelings, to kind of realize how much of it is my feelings and how much of it is my story, to be more descriptive and less tell the reader how to feel. So that was a tough one. And then after I went to my son, who was most important to me, my oldest son, and kind of said, I'm doing this. I'm giving you the draft. I'm going to publish it. But if there's anything you're not comfortable with, I want you to let me know, because I didn't want to ruin our relationship.
I'd like to take just a moment away from the episode to tell you about something that's really precious to us here at the Optimal State, and that's our Monday Night Sangha. There are so many of us that have come together for several years now on Monday nights. It's about an hour and a half class where we really set ourselves up for the week. We start with talking about one of the Yoga Sutra of Patanjali's as it pertains to our topic of the month. So in November, that is kind of reflecting on 2025 and thinking about how to go inward for November and December and really settle ourselves before we move into the new year. So we'll choose Yoga Sutra that are all about reflecting, all about going inward. And then possibly towards the end of the month, talk about setting intentions with powerful manifestation and how do we have a great 2026. So that's our topic for November. We do a little discussion, we do some postures, some breath work, a little bit of yoga nidra meditation, and then we come back at the end for another discussion. These are really potent sessions to start your week off right. We invite all of you. You can be there live or watch the recording, but we would love to have you with us on Monday nights, especially as we move into 2026. All right, everybody, let's get back to the podcast and thank you for listening.
And I did that with a few people and that was scary. It was really scary. I started with my siblings because they were safer to have them read it. And then I was ready to give it to my son. And then eventually I gave it to my mom too.
Wow.
So there were a lot of hard conversations that came up.
It's so brave. And, you know, I had written some things similar where you just get vignettes and I showed them to some of my family and they all said, hell no. They all were like, first of all, your version of reality is not the reality. It was like a real thing. So I kind of shut it down. But were they supportive? Were they neutral?
Yeah, in general, I think my siblings thought it was very interesting because depending on where you're born and what order, you have a different experience of what happened, you know. So I'm the oldest and I was there and I was grown up kind of when this happened, grown up early 20s, where a lot of them were kids or younger and some of them weren't even in town. So their experience of the whole ordeal and the whole arrest was very different. They were very curious. I think they were more curious and interested in, wow, that's not how I saw it, or that's not how I experienced it. And I would say that the people I was most afraid of surprised me. They didn't seem judgmental. They didn't seem to say, no way, if you do this, I'll never talk to you again, which was kind of my biggest fear. And when I got the courage to show them, I said, listen, this is my perspective and it's my story and it's my truth and I'm going to tell it. Because that's what I have to do. And I know that it might be hurtful and some things that I say may not feel good, but this is how I experience things. And somehow it worked out. You know, we had some difficult conversations, but nobody said, if you do this, I'm going to write you off. I'm never speaking to you again. There wasn't too much resistance. I tried to keep the story a lot about me. Mm-hmm. And the truth is, I don't think I make myself look amazing and wonderful. I think that I write honestly about, you know, my faults and roadblocks and things like that. I think that that made people feel more comfortable. It wasn't a rant. And at one point, I had to really look at the tone of the book to make sure that the tone wasn't angry or sad or poor me or, you know, carried these things, to try to stay as true to the details as possible so that the readers can really make up their own minds.
Yeah, like a video camera was following you around and watching you. It does have that tone. And I remember many, many years ago when we were discussing this book and you hadn't really decided if you were going to publish it yet. You said there are three parts to your life. You have the part as a young woman and kind of an Orthodox Jewish family and all that happened with your father. And then there was a phase where you moved to San Diego and you've got the whole California thing going on, the Baja events, you know, like that just seems like a totally different person. And then a whole nother version of you emerges when you move to Israel. It's almost like three lives in one book. Do you feel that way?
I felt that way when I wrote it. I hadn't initially thought about separating it into those parts because I was initially going to skip through time. And what transpired was really this realization that they were three sort of separate sections of my life that what moved with location. So it starts in Montreal, then in San Diego, then in Israel, but also these different versions of myself or different parts of myself that I was exploring. How Montreal, was very, very cold, very cold experience growing up. And it's a wonderful city. And that's the thing is I went back as I'm older and I realized, wow, this is an amazing city. It's gorgeous. There's so much to do. But when I was there, I was in a very constricted, very narrow community. And so my experience of Montreal was different. And that was, before I broke out of my religion and kind of away from my family and moved away from my place of birth. And then San Diego, as California is the best part of it is that nobody cares what you do and it's very free. But I also found my love for the sea and I started to explore things, but there weren't any boundaries in a way. There was a lot of searching and yearning still for family, I think. And my decision to move to Israel was to be closer to family, the family that I had living here. And to try to bring those two parts together, I think, there's still that part that really wanted us to be close and missed my family. I didn't just want to be alone, kind of gypsy wanderer, and at the same time, not lose my freedom. Freedom was really important, and my voice, which I didn't have when I was growing up.
There was a part in the book, I think it was around chapter 22, that you had this young baby and you were kind of a single mom, not that the dad wasn't somewhat involved, but you had gotten permission to move to Israel and you got to the airport and there were so many people there to greet you. And I wrote down, not alone anymore in Israel. And I remember when you moved there. I mean, we've known each other a while now. So
It's crazy.
Because we met in California in phase two. And I was like, wow,
Thank
she is taking a big step. Like she's moving across the world, right? But now to read that and see that you kind of had a built-in support system there. And I don't know, I'm even imagining, I don't know if this is true, you can tell me, but it seems like in Israel, they take care of you. I don't want to say much better than in the United States, but like education and maybe healthcare services, like there's a little more support and safety net. Is that true?
It's actually very true. When I arrived, yes, my family was there to greet me, and there also was like a whole party, because I came on an airplane of people who were moving, making aliyah. They call it making aliyah, meaning going upward, like you're going up. And there was a very famous musician who played. So it was a big celebration landing, and they make a big deal out of it, which is nice for those of us who really sold everything and literally. It's a lot of work. It's a lot of work to move countries to a new language. That excitement fades quickly, just to say. But to answer your question, I would say that overall, the biggest difference is that it's not just about family support. There feels like there's much more of a sense of community or caring that people have for one another. In the United States is so big and people are so far away from their family and people are weary of one another in the street. And that doesn't exist here, I guess, because it's a smaller country. There is a, kind of a common issue of a lot of trouble and war. And so people take care of each other. They take care of each other's kids. If anyone sees a child like who's crying in the street, five people will run over and help them. And I didn't have that feeling in the States. There were times where I was sick and I was a single mom and I wasn't sure who I could call for help. I didn't want to inconvenience people. I felt, very alone at times. I think there's an overarching sense of loneliness that I felt. And I know others have described that as well in the States, where you kind of feel like you're on your own. It's sink or swim, People are nice and they're there. And we all have a few good friends that will, hold us up. But overall, you kind of feel like you're wandering alone in the world or in the streets. And I would say that something about being here, that feeling isn't there. It isn't there. It's you can knock on your neighbor's door and ask for anything. if you need something, if somebody falls on the street. My mother fell and dislocated her shoulder on a bus. The bus stopped. And a girl literally went with her to the hospital. They didn't just call the hospital, put her in an ambulance. She went with her because there was no family nearby, stayed with her all day, and then called us until people could come. They go the extra mile, I would say. It's just part of the culture to be concerned and care. And there's a little bit more warmth, even though I know that it's hard to say that, given everything that's going on in the world right now. But this is what the community is like here. People really do take care of each other and they do care about one another.
And do you think that's like basic Jewish values? I always laugh because every one of my
No.
best friends has always been Jewish. I'm like, what is it? What is it that I like about Jewish people? Or is it all of the tragedy that you've been through together? Or is it both or something else?
I think there's a big difference between American Jewry and the Jews in Israel. And I think that that's what I was searching for. I think the opposite in Montreal, for example, where I grew up, it was not like that. It was very much, don't tell anyone what's really going on. Keep a pretty face, look good, show everyone that you're fine and great. And, so there was always this, it wasn't safe. Didn't feel safe to be authentic. It was a popularity contest, who had the most money. I also spent some time in New York. It was very similar there, that there was a lot of competition. There isn't that warmth, in my opinion, in the Orthodox community in North America. I think Israelis are very different. And even when I lived in San Diego, I befriended many Israelis who were there for, postdocs, and a lot of people come for the sciences or for medical school and different things. And I always just found them so much warmer and so much friendlier. And it's just cultural, I think, because it's such a small place and kids are very free. People are fine with their neighbor's kids coming over without knocking, like walking in the house, sitting down and eating. Like, it's just a very different kind of kibbutz-like culture. And I think it's unique to Israel. I don't think it's necessarily a Jewish thing. I do think family is very Jewish and getting together every Friday night. And so there's a lot of family values. But the extra warmth or the extra connection, I think, that I feel is different. I think it's cultural rather than religious.
I mean, I'm speaking to some of my friends in Israel that literally are sitting in a bomb shelter and then coming back to work the next day. Like, I can't imagine that life where you're kind of moving back and forth between these two things.
When I moved here, things were not that it was ever peaceful or there wasn't an element of kind of, feeling danger or feeling threats, but it was never like this. This last 2 years have been really unique. So I have to say that I had a good 10 years here without being in a state of constant war. So this episode, this last couple of years, is very different than everything. And even as I talk to Israelis, they do feel that now there's nothing like what's happening now. It's never been like this. It's very strange. It's very strange. I don't think anyone can understand unless you kind of are here. Maybe that's one of the reasons we know our neighbors so well, because we see each other three times in the middle of the night in the bomb shelter downstairs, and we sit together and we're all going through the same thing. And we collectively go through a lot of pain. And there's a lot of different belief systems, and some people who are for the government, some people who are not. There's religious, non-religious. We're all together, though, in the bomb shelter. So, yeah, I can't really describe what it is, except it's unlike anything that I've ever experienced.
That's so important what you just pointed out, that each of you has your unique beliefs and ways of being in the world and values and agree or disagree. It's not like all of Israel feels one way.
Not at all, no.
Oof.
But I think a lot of us went through, after this, the Iran war, this recent war, a lot of very difficult feelings and regulation issues in our nervous system, because it was very much like that. It was very much like, we're going to enter a huge war, get ready. It's going to be 2 weeks of you being in a shelter. and then kind of going through that. And then one day them saying, okay, it's over, go back to work tomorrow. Literally, like that. And it was very strange. A lot of people spoke about how they felt body pain, exhaustion, depression. It was not an easy transition. A lot of us just went back and then 2 days later crashed because our nervous system was on such high alert. Luckily, I have the yoga and the yoga therapy, and we have the tools to regulate and to understand what's happening. So we're able to not freak out when it's happening. But it was the first time I really felt the power of the nervous system and how it releases the stress, and different for everyone.
And so I can't help but think with your yoga therapy, and even your Hakomi background, which I think you said is like a somatic psychotherapy. Do you feel like those things are going to expand in Israel because needed so much?
I do. I think that if anything, yoga therapy is growing as a community, and I'm part of that, part of trying to bring it here and help it grow. And it has been growing, but now it's more relevant than ever because it's the one thing that really works with the body, with the mind, and with the nervous system, and with the spirit at the same time. And everyone is traumatized. Everyone. So there's no one who doesn't have some form of trauma at this point, some more than others. And usually a physical injury or a disease or something that they're going through, or grief from someone that they lost. And the losses are very close to home. One thing I noticed as I'm going into the hospitals, trying to bring yoga therapy in, is saying, okay, they have integrative medicine. You can do reflexology and acupuncture, but those are passive treatments that help people very much. But the person is, having the treatment done to them. There's physical therapy where they're working on their physical mobility. There's psychotherapy where you're talking. But yoga therapy is active. It teaches people how to take these tools and develop a practice so they have them for the long haul. And it addresses both the mind and the body. And I think the medical system is saying, hey, this is what we need now. I'm seeing it. I'm seeing a lot of need. And so part of me being here is like, okay, maybe this is partially my dharma of just coming here and helping people who are suffering by bringing something a little bit more holistic, that they might not otherwise have access to in healthcare.
Rachel, how did you get them to listen and to really understand that the world needs yoga therapy more than ever? And there's so many people that are having trouble translating it to the doctors who have so little time to even learn about this new thing. Once they do get it, they're like, oh, yes, we 100% need that. But how did you get in there? How did you educate them about it to even let them know what you could do?
Partly, I think, because of the proximity of Israel to India and that fact that a lot of Israelis travel to India after their army service, yoga is quite accepted here. And there are some really good teachers and a strong yoga community, not yoga therapy, but yoga per se, with people who've lived in India, traveled to India often. And so even people in high tech or in medicine, almost everyone has practiced yoga or tried yoga. So it's not something alternative or strange for people here. And I would say that they probably get less of the fitness yoga and more of the whole picture of yoga in Israel compared to the United States, where it kind of became a little bit more body oriented. In Israel, I feel like they hold on to the roots, that a lot of the philosophy is very embedded in it as a general observation on my part. A lot of it is, we went into hospitals, we knocked on doors, we talked to people. Almost everyone has practiced, their wife practices yoga usually. You just have to find someone that believes in the value, who's in a position of, in the medical field. And then we showed the research. I have to say, the research that we've been doing that has been done in the United States, in India, the efforts of the symposium on yoga research and all of those things is really, really important because I'm coming with all the articles, I'm coming with the accreditation, I'm coming with this is what they're doing in the US, or this is what they're teaching in Maryland. There's a program. So they're seeing that there's something there. And I do believe that the hospitals here want to stay up to par with what's happening in North America and in the world. So if something's happening there, they want it here as well. So it's a combination of familiarity with yoga, the desire to get more into integrative medicine, and also luck, falling on the right ears and having people believe in you. It's not easy. Not everyone's excited about it, but I do believe it's ripe. I believe that now is the time.
It's so interesting. It feels like it's this culmination of it's a smaller place than the United States. Like you said, people travel to India a lot and bring back the holistic ideas from India. And people are suffering and having major trauma responses. And here you are like, hey, I have a solution. Look here, I've got some research. I mean, that's like this perfect storm for you.
Yeah, they're implementing a lot of trauma-sensitive yoga in many, many different environments, in defense forces, in schools, with children. People are seeing the benefits and they're not turning their eyes away. Unless we take care of the soul, the body won't heal.
Yeah.
So people believe it, but you're right. There isn't time. There isn't budget. There's a lot of issues, just like everywhere else in the world. We're going to keep pushing it because it does help and it does work. The patients that we've touched who've been through multiple traumas in the hospital have raved to their doctors, to their therapists, to their, you know, families. I'm getting calls from family members. They had someone they knew who was in the hospital and they met a yoga therapist in the hospital who happened to have been our student, and how much she touched his life and how helpful it was. And that more and more of those stories are coming out. So I think as the patients express their gratitude and how much it helped them in their healing process, the caregivers are listening.
It's so interesting. I think because we're not a super recognized discipline in healthcare yet, we start to doubt ourselves. We start to kind of have an inferiority complex, and maybe what I'm doing isn't sacred. It's not special. You know, these people can teach the breathing. Those people can do the mental stuff. Other people can do the physical stuff. What's left for us? Like, there's so much self-doubt that we have as individuals in this field. And yet when you get that feedback from actual clients that are like, wow, this is different. This brought it all together in a very unique way. I feel like we need to like sit down with a focus group and look at the people like you that have been successful in getting it in the door. And like, what are the points that we need to be hitting to help doctors, nurses, healthcare providers, administrators understand what we're doing? Because I think they would all want it if they understood it.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing that we heard from a lot of people was that after practicing the yoga and especially the breathing, it was the first time they didn't feel pain. A lot of them said that in weeks. And then, you know, we had one patient say that they were, you know, crying in the middle of the night in their room, hospital room, and they wanted pain medication. And their neighbor, they had someone in the room next to them. And she's like, remember what she taught us to do in yoga. Remember, let's breathe. And they breathed. Stories like this. And then she didn't need the pain meds. Things like that. We're hearing a lot of those success stories. When we speak to hospitals and healthcare, you know, we have to talk in terms of results. You know, how does this help the healthcare system? But if we can prove maybe less pain, less need for medication, improve mobility, shorten length of stay, kind of looking at outcome measures and getting better at proving that. And that's what we're trying to do now, is to get little pilot research projects or questionnaires out there and start to come to them with, see, this is going to improve outcomes, save money, improve quality of life.
Yeah. Those are the things that they want to see.
Yeah. Yeah.
I want to read a little part as we come close to the end here from your epilogue that really touched me. So do you mind if I read a little bit?
Not at all. Go ahead.
Rachel says, yoga originally provided me with a safe place to befriend my body and to start to feel some semblance of peace with non-doing. I would enter yoga class with a storm of thoughts and anxieties, which somehow quieted by the end of class. Simply having permission to relax was a new concept, and it was difficult at first. After a time spent practicing, I started to notice my thoughts as if they were in the observer. They were the observer of the outside. There was a space between my strong emotions and my reactions to my thoughts. I began to respond with more care to different situations, and I was able to see more perspectives than my own. I was able to be less focused on myself and more present to others, especially my children. I wasn't sure how stretching and holding poses led this to happen, but there was a clear and obvious change. Soon, I started to be able to face difficult emotions. I was able to feel deep sadness without too much judgment, and I craved time alone. Sometimes my feelings were downright awful, but deep down, I knew I needed to embrace them. I loved that part when I got to it. So simple, but that's exactly what happens to us. We need to somehow figure out what that chain of events is, because I think you really clearly were able to articulate the experience that so many of us have had.
It doesn't happen in one moment. It's not a one-time thing or one class thing. It's if you stick with it, that's the important thing, I think, is sticking with it and not expecting anything, but these things do happen. It does start to change if you're consistent, if you dedicate yourself to the practice. And you don't try too hard. You don't have to do anything. You just have to show up.
It's interesting that you say that. I was talking to a pretty major researcher from the University of Minnesota recently, and she said, Amy, we don't need studies that show an hour of yoga can make you feel better, or even 6 weeks of yoga can make you feel better. She said, we need to see what happens to people over decades. And I was like, whoa. So like a longitudinal study over how we shift and, you know, measuring every year, maybe over 20 years and see how we shift. That planted a seed for me. I thought that was super interesting.
I agree. I mean, I know we all feel better 1 week, 6 weeks into it, but you're right. I think the more meaningful changes take time. Think about it. You know, I'm practicing 25 years. I'm still working on things, but I'm not the same person that I was. And I do believe that a big part of that is owed to yoga. And even just to be able to go into psychotherapy and to benefit from that required me to kind of quiet my mind enough to be able to feel things, because what I did was numb out, you know, just stay busy, move, not stop, just keep going, keep working, keep producing, and didn't allow myself time to feel because it was painful. And so I do think if I hadn't practiced yoga, a lot of the benefits of psychotherapy or benefits of, you know, even talk therapy, I wouldn't have gotten the same benefits.
Yeah. So, Rachel, is there any last words of wisdom or anything you'd like to tell us about your book? Because I really feel, maybe I'm overstretching here, but I really feel it has so much potential to go outside the yoga community. I feel it could be made a movie. I feel like it could almost be like Eat, Love, Pray. This was a good story. Do you have any thoughts, or are you just kind of staying with the fact that, okay, I released this book, let's just stay here for a moment?
No, I actually thought the same thing. They came out with another movie on Netflix a while ago, Unorthodox. I don't know if you saw that one, which was really interesting. Similar, again, different story, different type of Judaism, much more extreme. But I don't think it's a yoga story. That's the truth. I think that yoga is a big part of the story, and that it's what helped me not identify with difficult emotions, with shame, and helped me get out of some destructive patterns. But it's not a yoga story. It's a human story. It's a story of coming into life and getting handed your cards, you know, born into whatever family, whatever culture, whatever language, whatever sex you are, and having a messy start and, you know, noticing that I'm doing this and it's not working. And eventually it takes time to notice patterns because, you know, you only notice it's a pattern once it's happened many, many times. And sometimes we stop and we say, I don't want to do this anymore. It's not serving me, right? And so this is really hope for everybody who's had a rough start, who's going through difficult times, whether it's on the outside or on the inside. You know, it's not about really what happens to you. It's just about if you feel that there's something more for you in this life and something, you know, that you would like to achieve. I hope it's a timeless story that will reach many people all over the world. But I told it through the lens of yoga and through the lens of the somatic work that I did. I'm hoping that it will touch people's lives and help them realize that there's always hope and that they are not their story. And there's one other message if I can leave your audience with. I think what I did have to learn was that you can run, but you can't hide. You know, wherever you go, there you are. And so the work really needs to happen inside. You need to go inward, not outward, to chase what it is that you're missing.
Thank you so much, not just for sharing your story with us, but sharing yourself with us. Like I said, I think in being so authentic and just open and honest, you've given so many of us permission to kind of think or even be willing to let go of the shame of whatever we've gone through and been through trying to survive in this life.
Thank you. I will say that I'm still not without fear and trepidation as people I know are reading this book, but it's okay. It's okay to be scared and do it anyway.
Thank you so much, Rachel.
Thank you, Amy.
Rachel, I just want to thank you for being so honest, so authentic, for giving us permission to allow ourselves to be seen, even when we're flawed and imperfect, to help us remember that we don't have to beat ourselves up. We don't have to shame ourselves or judge ourselves. And even if others want to do that, that's their business. It really doesn't have any reflection on who you are, Rachel, as a human, who each of us is as a human. So that feeling of being okay to be judged by others and still moving forward with your dharma and your life, it's just been a theme that's been coming up for me so much lately. And I'm seeing a lot of people going through the same thing. And I'm even seeing the field of yoga therapy go through this same thing that we've been imperfect. We've made some mistakes. We have stumbled, and we may even be on our knees as a field of yoga therapy, at least in North America, it feels that way. I think there's many places in the world that yoga therapy is thriving, not just surviving, but I feel like in the Western world of the United States, maybe even Canada, we don't know who we are. I've even talked to some people in Australia. It's like, what are we doing? Where have we been going the last 20 years? Where are we going from here? And after listening to Rachel's story, I just have this little bit of hope that yoga therapy is not dying, is not dead, it's being reborn. That's what Rachel's story made me think while I was interviewing her. I'm like, wow, Rachel was reborn multiple times. And then I thought, yoga therapy has to let some things shed. We have to shed before we can be reborn. And I think we're really at a critical juncture here where we are being reborn. So I ask each of you to have that faith, to not feel shame, to not feel judged, to not think we're through and why have we done all this and we're so terrible. No, yoga therapy is goodness. It's benevolence. It's what the healthcare world needs. We just have to find a way to explain to people all that we're able to help them with. And so we are being reborn like a butterfly. It is a painful process and it's happening. It's happening. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and we will see you next week. Thank you for listening to the Yoga Therapy Hour. We appreciate you as our listeners because without you, there would be no Yoga Therapy Hour. It's your comments, your calls, your emails, your texts of support and well wishes and affirmations that keeps us going. So don't feel hesitant to give us a review if you've been enjoying the podcast. Go wherever it is that you listen, find the review section, and let people know how much you love the Yoga Therapy Hour. It's a small thing that you could do for us that would help spread the word of goodness, benevolence, and help us help all the people out there to suffer less. All right, everybody, have a great week. We'll see you next week.
Thank you for listening to the Yoga Therapy Hour. We wish you a wonderful week. We hope that somehow, in a small way, we've contributed to your well-being so that you can go out and share that well-being with others. That's what life is all about, bringing in the goodness through you and then shining it out to the world. We need you more than ever. So let's all get out there, do good, be good, and have a great week.